Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today is the last episode in a series on the history of railroads. I never meant this series to be comprehensive or exhausted, but merely a brief survey. We're going to talk about railroads again in the future as we chart the development of California and specifically the Central Valley. But I wanted to start with the origins of the Transcontinental Railroad because it is one of the most important parts of California's history and California's relationship to the rest of the Union. I hope you've been enjoying a number of the interview episodes that I've posted. Those episodes are so much fun for me, and I have so many great ones in store for you over the next couple weeks and months. I hope you enjoy them. And please, if you haven't already, please subscribe to my Substack page, which is just my first and last name, Jordan Maddox, where I post a lot of content. Right now I'm going through two series. One, I'm reading most of the major John Steinbeck novels over the course of this year, and I'm planning a number of podcasts to discuss them with experts. And then I'm also going through the history of the governors of California, starting from the very first governor all the way to Gavin Newsom. I believe that by studying governors, we can understand a lot about what was going on in the state at that point in time, not comprehensively, but from a vantage point that allows you to see some of the broad currents at work in the state at that time. And finally, on Saturdays, I've been posting about different important poets in California's history. So if any of that content interests you, I'd encourage you to subscribe to my Substack, and which I will link below in the show notes for today's episode. Without further ado, let's get into our final discussion, at least in the near term. Let's get into our final discussion for this series on railroads. Given the financial outlays by governments, both national and subnational, the general public had an expectation that the railroad would be built quickly. The railroad companies themselves also wanted construction to move as rapidly as possible, as the Union Pacific and Central Pacific were racing each other to construct. As much track as possible. Given all of the incentives that went per mile with each amount, given all the incentives that each mile of track gave to the respective companies, one would have thought that the pace had been rapid. Accordingly, when it came to safety, the Big Four, who were considered by the point that construction began as saviors of the West, started to sacrifice safety in the sake of profits. However, as we discussed last time, making progress through the Sierra Nevada mountains was going to be slow, regardless of the number of workers they had on the job. When the Central Pacific was still working on the valley floor, they were averaging about 50 miles per year. The terrain was uniform, so the task could be completed without having to modify the approach. Once the Central Pacific reached the foothills of these Sierra Nevadas, the pace of progress slowed down significantly. It could be as slow as a mile a week, which, in keep in mind, the Central Pacific was ramping up to almost 15,000 workers under employment. It would take the Central Pacific almost 3 years to make it across the 150 miles of terrain of the Sierra Nevadas. The Union Pacific, by contrast, would not run into the same challenges when building their lines on the other side of the Sierras, all but guaranteeing that the Central Pacific would accrue more land over the course of construction. In spite of the boosterism, government subsidies and support, and the economic boom of Chinese immigration and the employments of thousands of people, there were a few concerns that did arise from the imminent arrival of a continent-spanning railway to California. One of the main concerns was, simply put, the reality of change. Human beings are naturally resistant to change. And if the relative status quo is recent, like the population and society that was created as a result like the population and society that was created as a result of the gold rush, there are many who like the arrangement as they were, and would be resistant to any kind of change. The railroad was going to essentially erase the barriers to entry with moving west. The time to circumnavigate South America or take a wagon across the vast ranges and basins that are the western half of the United States would essentially be erased via the railroad. In addition to that, some of the risks, crossing Nicaragua or parts of Central America or staying on a ship for long periods of time, involved risks to body and health. Those risks were now gone. One of the ways that the railroads and railroad companies tried to control the narrative was by influencing the press. Initially, they tried to influence Eastern opinions about the enterprise, where it was perceived by leadership in the railroad companies that the most important and influential individuals were located. However, articles were pushed in the newspapers with a level of pushiness that came from a place of entitlement that the public had a duty to support these business magnates trying to piece the continent together. Negative press was impossible to avoid, ultimately. The press viewed their role as trying to influence the direction and leadership of the railroad companies. The Big Four, however, did not believe that they should have to deal with this or be responsive to the newspaper-created opinion, such that they even considered buying the newspapers, and sometimes did. This is not unusual. In my interview with Dr. Sandra Bonura, we discussed how the Spreckles family, a large sugar conglomerate, was able to purchase San Diego newspapers in an attempt to control the narrative around their legacy and their business dealings. The Big Four not only wanted to control the press, but they also wanted to control the political environment. They wanted to expand their expected profits and mitigate any risk by locking in rates. We've already discussed Stanford's time as governor, which was likely the central way that they influenced politics at the state level. In addition to having a man in the governor's mansion, they also tried to exert influence over the legislature by bribing politicians, making campaign contributions with an expectation of loyalty, and lobbying certain legislators who ran important committees that related to transportation, land use, and railroads. This not only happened at the state level, but the federal level as well, primarily managed by Colas Huntington. This led to the passage of the Pacific Railroad Act. This led to the passage of the Pacific Railways Acts. We've discussed the original act in 1862, but it was also revived in 1864. But it was also revised in 1864. The revision in 1864 increased the amount of land granted to railroad companies, sped the credit process to avoid funding delays, and granted rights to minerals and timber discovered within the area of railroad construction. The first passenger train made its way across the vast and vaulting Sierra Nevada range in 1868, beginning in California and ending in Reno, Nevada. After that point, the terrain flattens out as we get into what is referred to as the area of basin and range. The next year, the Central Pacific and Union Pacific would famously meet in Promontory Point. Before describing its significance and importance for California, let's hear how a number of newspapers covered the event, because I think this is incredibly illuminating as to its importance. The first newspaper we'll look at is the Omaha Herald. This article was published on May 12, 1869. It reads, "Monday, May 10, 1869 will be forever memorable in the history of Omaha. Not to Omaha alone, however, will it mark the commencement of an important epoch. It shall be remembered through all time as the starting point of a newer, broader, and greater civilization that has hitherto dawned upon the progress of the world. The union of two great Pacific railroads, which with their connections spanned a continent, and simultaneously kiss with iron lips the waters of two oceans, is an event so important in its bearing to the well-being and future progress of mankind as not to be passed over without serious thought and reflection." The next newspaper we'll look at is the New York Times. This article, which was published on May 11, 1869, is called East and West. The excerpt reads, "The long-looked-for moment has arrived. The construction of the Pacific Railroad is un fait accompli. The inhabitants of the Atlantic and the dwellers of the Pacific Slope are henceforth emphatically one people. Your correspondent is writing at Promontory Summit near... Your correspondent is writing at Promontory Summit amid the deafening shouts of the multitude, with the tick-tick of the telegraph close to his ear. It was apparent throughout the city yesterday that an event of more than usual importance was taking place, and that there was an evident disposition among the people to be jubilant. The last rail of the road connecting our opposite ocean-bound shores was laid. The last spike, a gold one, by the by, was driven. And thereupon there was a booming of cannon, peals from Trinity chimes, and general rejoicing over the completion of the great enterprise, in the success of which not only this country, but the whole civilized world is directly interested." All right. Our last article is from the Montana Post in Helena. Our last article is from the Montana Post in Helena in May 14th, 1869. It reads, "Yesterday, May 10th, at high noon, the last rail was laid and spiked, connecting the Union and Central Pacific Railroads. It was the completion of an enterprise fraught with more interest than the tunneling of Mount Cenis or connecting the Red and Mediterranean Seas by the Suez Canal. Exchanges and telegrams inform us that on the Pacific and Atlantic coasts, it was to be celebrated with becoming ceremonies and popular demonstrations. From down in the deserts of Utah, we have rumors of gold spikes and silver spikes, diamond eyes, ruby lips, alabaster necks, sparkling vintage wit, sentiment, and whatnot that grace the occasion and fasten the rail. Success to the great enterprise and a volunteer toast from Success to the great enterprise and a volunteer toast from Montana." All right, so here are some of the basics about what happened on this famous day. Originally, the chosen location for the ceremony was Ogden, Utah, but that location ran into some challenges when negotiating between the two railroad companies. Accordingly, the government was forced to intervene and selected Promontory Summit. The who's who of dignitaries and government officials were on site to be part of this historic event, marking when the United States truly became a continental power. Additionally, we saw in my quotations earlier, journalists from around the country were dispatched to cover the event for their respective communities. Finally, there were many railroad workers in attendance as well. There were actually four spikes that were nailed in to signify the completion of the gold. There were actually four spikes that were nailed into the ground to signify the completion of the railroad across the continent. Two golden spikes, which came from California, a silver spike from Nevada, and Arizona's combination of silver and gold spike. The famous spike, one of the golden ones, was created by David Hughes, who was a friend to Leland Stanford. He made it after discovering the lack of commemoration symbols for the completion of the railroad line. Hughes actually donated his own gold to create the spike, which turned out to be around $350 or $8,000 in today's money. The spike has engravings all over it. Some are names of railroad officers and directors, and a few phrases including, "The Pacific Railroad ground broken Jan 8, 1863, and completed May 8, 1869. And another one of those insignia, "May God continue the unity of our country as this railroad unites the two great oceans of the world," presented by David Hughes of San Francisco. The top of the spike says, "The last spike." The other three spikes also were inscribed with various phrases. The actual ceremony itself was moderated by Dr. H.W. Harkness, a fascinating character who dabbled in everything from real estate to editing a newspaper to work in natural history. After Harkness gave a prolix presentation, he presented the two golden spikes to Leland Stanford and two others to Thomas Durant of the Union Pacific. Stanford gave a boisterous speech, and Durant gave his turn at the podium to Union Pacific's chief engineer, who spoke briefly. Stanford, gave a boisterous speech, and Durant, by contrast, actually gave his turn at the podium to the Union Pacific's chief engineer, who spoke briefly. Following the speeches, Stanford drove the spikes in the earth, marking a new epoch in American history. We'll close this episode with the text of Stanford's speech, which I'll read in full. Quote, "Gentlemen, the Pacific Railroad companies accept with pride and satisfaction these gold and silver tokens of your appreciation of the importance of our enterprise to the material interests of the sections which you represent on this occasion, and to the material interests of our whole country, east and west, north and south. These gifts shall receive a fitting place in the superstructure of our road. And before laying the tie and driving the spikes in completion of the Pacific Railway, allow me to express the hope that the great importance which you are pleased to attach to our undertaking may be, in all respects, the speed forerunner of increased facilities. The Pacific Railway will, as soon as commerce shall begin, fully to realize its advantages, demonstrate the necessity of rich improvements in railroading, as to render practicable the transportation of freights at much less rates than are possible under any system which is thus far anywhere adopted. The day is not far distant when three tracks will be found necessary to accommodate commerce and travel, which will seek a transit across this continent. Freight will then move only on one way each track and at rates of speed that will answer the demands of cheapness and time. Cars and engines will be light or heavy, according to the speed required and the weight to be transported. In conclusion, I will add that we hope to do ultimately what is now impossible on long lines, transport coarse and heavy cheap products for all distances at living rates to the trade. Now, gentlemen, with your assistance, we will proceed to lay the last tie, the last rail, and drive the last spike." The history of railroads is fascinating, and we could go on and on, but we must proceed, like this podcast, forward and onward to future subjects. We'll see you next time. Thank you.